I'm sorry, man. I got magic, and I got poetry at my fingertips, and I'm, you know, at most of the time, and this is, you know, this includes naps. You know, I'm an F-18, bro, and I will destroy you in the air, and I will deploy my ordnance to the ground.
Well, just like a crack-addled rant on nationally syndicated radio, this is episode 36.
It's not an accident at all.
Of the Air Raid Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Roden.
You don't want to get mixed up with a guy like me.
And yeah, you do not want to get messed up with a guy like me, especially a guy that uses sound drops from Pee Wee Herman's Playhouse. Not a good idea, people. Not a good idea. Anyway, this is the show where we drop bombs of awesome into your ear holes. And man, we got a lot of awesome to drop on you today. We did not do a episode last week, and I apologize about that. But I just I wasn't feeling like myself, and I was lazy, as those of you who listen know, or those of you who have listened in the past know. I am a very lazy person, and it takes a lot to motivate me. And we had a cancellation on the calendar, so I just figured what a great time to watch Piranha again and again and again. Yes, that's right, everybody. I have found yet another movie that I can watch over and over and over again, and that movie is Piranha. You guys need to check this out. It is so good. I don't know who of you out there like really campy, cheesy horror movies with lots of boobs and blood in them. But if you do, if you're a fan of that kind of cinema, I would suggest Piranha for all of you. I don't have a lot of movies out there that I can watch over and over again. Let's name them off here. We got Star Wars, the original Star Wars trilogy. I can watch over and over. Spaceballs, because it has to do with Star Wars. I can watch over and over again. And what else? What else is there? Not much. Not much at all. I think it's just Star Wars, Spaceballs, and now Piranha that I can watch over and over and over again. There's got to be something else out there that I'm missing. Anyway, we went to the Marc Maron show last night at Laughs in Kirkland, and had a great time. That guy is so funny. We actually went to the second show. We got there. Laughs is kind of a weird place. It's in a strip mall in the city of Kirkland, which is north of Seattle here, Seattle proper. And we got there, and yeah, it was in the middle of this strip mall. We got there a little bit early, and they weren't opening the doors until about 9:45. Because Mark was doing two shows last night. So we went over to this Chinese restaurant, which, by the way, I don't know what it is about Chinese restaurants, but my clothes reek. They absolutely reek. Like, I'm wearing my pants, the pants that I wore last night right now, and it keeps on wafting up. And no, it's not, you know, what you're thinking. Very funny, y'all. No, it's the smell is coming off my pants. It's all over my jacket. I can't get it out of my jacket. I was going to wear the same shirt today, because I like to do that on weekends. But I can't do that now because the shirt reeks of Chinese restaurant. You know, I would rather have the smell of smoke on my clothing than Chinese food. And by the way, what's that Chinese aroma doing to my lungs? If it won't get out of your clothes, what the hell are you breathing in those places? I don't know. But yeah, back to this, the Marc Maron show. So we went and he did some stand-up there at Laughs in Kirkland. It was a great show. It was super, super cold last night. We had to wait outside. I think it was a sold-out show because it was packed in there. But it was very funny, and man, that guy has the amazing ability to just really spill his guts at the same time as making it humorous. And if it wasn't humorous, it would just be very sad, right? I mean, I don't know how many of you have listened to his podcast, WTF, but it's one of the best. It's one of the best. And I urge anybody who has not heard that podcast that you need to check it out, because it's one of my favorites, and I listen to it. I think he posts them twice a week. But yeah, he has this great ability to just kind of spill his guts and tell these real life stories and make them comical, because they're so crazy and they're so sad. You just have to laugh at it because he's laughing at himself, right? And he does really, really well at it, too. I mean, you can tell the guy has just been doing comedy for a really long time, because he's got it down. He's got it down. And he stood up there, and it's, you know, laughs is not like Paramount size. You know, it's not the show box in downtown Seattle. It's a smaller place, smaller venue in a strip mall. Maybe once used to be an Azteca. I don't know. The jury is out on that one. But anyway, yeah, he was up there for, I don't know, it felt like an hour and a half. And it was just amazing. It was great. We had a great time. We met him afterwards and got a picture with him and stuff, and then we left. And as we're pulling out of the parking lot, I had, because many of you know, I tried to get Mark on the Air Raid show. While he is in town this weekend, took about a month of correspondence with his people, over the emails, and they declined in the end. But so we start pulling out of the parking lot there, and I'm like, Murray, drive back around. I'm gonna just hate myself if I don't try, you know. So I ran back inside, and, you always, like, with people like that, you know, because he goes and sits in the back, and people just come up to him and they say, hey, can we take your picture, and, you know, talk to him for a little bit and stuff. And it's always so awkward in those situations to be the guy or the lady, you know, we're not sexist here on the Air Raid podcast, to be the person, I should say, that has to stand there and like, wait in line to say something to somebody you admire or somebody, you know, famous. And so that was me last night. I stood there for a little bit and waited for my opening. And I said, hey, look, man, you know, I would kill myself if I didn't try doing that. First mistake right there, kill myself. First mistake of sounding crazy. That's number one, okay? Number one mistake was sounding like a fucking stalker. I'm going to kill myself if I don't do this. But, yeah, so number one mistake. And then I normalized, and I said, I do a podcast called AirRaid.net, and, you know, I'd love to have the chance to do an interview with you. And I gave him my card and had my phone number on it and stuff. You know, he asked me what my reach was. How many listeners do we have? And you know what? I don't really know. I don't know. So I just kind of pulled a number out of the air. And he said, well, he said he'd think about it. So I don't think it's going to happen. Maybe sometime in the future. But anyway, regardless, super nice guy. It was cool to get to meet him and to see his stand-up routine. Which is not really a routine, I guess. He's got so much material, probably just, you know, memorized, has everything just about memorized, and just goes through all that stuff. Man, what a great show. So I would urge any of you who have the chance to see him live, go and check that out. But don't go to a Chinese restaurant beforehand. So not only did I smell, like I realized this morning, I not only did I smell like a Chinese restaurant, but I also was saying stuff like a fucking crazy person. So now it's never going to happen, right? Fuck. Anyway. We've got a great show planned for you guys today. A little bit later, we're going to have Eric Axelson, the bass player from the Dismemberment Plan, on, and we'll be talking to him in a little while here. He's going to call in. I think they're in, like, D.C. right now or Chicago, somewhere other than Seattle. But they are going to be playing a show in Seattle soon, actually next month. And if you haven't heard the Dismemberment Plan, we're going to be featuring music from them all episode. So, and it's really good stuff. I love this band. I absolutely love them. It was one of those bands that like, when I first found out about them, I was in college, and it was one of those albums, like Emergency and I, which is being re-released by Barsuk, by the way, which is why they kind of got back together. And doing the small tour, but the their album Emergency and I, which was super super good, I found out about them in college, and that was one of the albums that I just like put on heavy rotation. And by heavy rotation, I mean like I didn't take the CD out of the CD player ever, like for at least for like a month. That was like the one thing that I listened to over and over again. And I probably just drove my roommates crazy. But it's really good, and you guys should check that out. So we'll be talking to him a little bit later. First, man, Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen is really going AWOL here, people. And, you know, I heard somebody say this the other day, I think on another radio program. About Charlie Sheen, but you know what? Who gives a shit? Let him do his thing, man. Like now, I mean, they're talking now how you know, they've basically canceled the rest of this season of his show, Two and a Half Men, which I say more power to you, because that show was fucking so bad. And no offense to people who liked it, it was not my cup of tea. My grandparents really liked it. I was staying with my grandparents for a little bit before I got my first job in Seattle. Yeah, that's right. I stayed with my grandparents, or as my brother would call them, my roommates. Old roommates. But my grandparents really liked that show, and I'd like come home from work, and they'd be watching that stuff, and it was just so awkward. Because, you know, it's very like most of their... most of their jokes on that show are all very sexually orientated. Or is that a word? Orientated? No, oriented. Yeah. Whoa. Man, I need some more coffee. Sexually oriented. That was like a Sarah Palin mix-up right there. It's like a word that she would say. Man, am I getting dumber? I don't know. But anyway, yeah, it was always very awkward when my grandparents would watch that show, because it was all those gross jokes, and just like looking over at my grandma and seeing her just laugh and laugh. I was like, no, grandma, you don't do that. Anyway, but yeah, I was listening to this radio show the other night. And they were talking about, you know what, who cares what Charlie Sheen does? You know, the problem with drug addicts is that usually, in most cases, is that they steal and do, you know, break the law in order to keep up their drug habit. But if you're a multimillionaire who's not really harming anybody except for himself and his teeth, by the way, holy shit. Well, he is harming his teeth, but I'm not sure that those would count as a separate entity. But why not just let him do it? Like, he's made of money, you know, and I bet, like, he gets paid from the re-airing of those shows, like the reruns and stuff. Actually, wait a minute. No, I did hear that he does not get paid for that. They pay him a shit ton of money up front, and then he doesn't get anything on the back end. But anyway, that's beside the point. But why not just let him do it? Like, you know, until he actually starts becoming a real problem, like, just let him go for it, I guess. And, you know, another thing is, like, he doesn't usually get into trouble when he's actually working. So, like, why not just keep the show going, get him back into work, clean himself up while he's working, and then don't ever give him any time off. Like, that's the thing right there. You give him time off, and he's going to go and just fucking party, you know? But anyway, it is kind of sad. You know, you gotta feel for his family that just has to watch this, like, unfold. But, man, we as Americans, you cannot be American without loving to watch these train wrecks nowadays. It's just like it's almost like a daily occurrence. And I was thinking, I saw a commercial for The Apprentice, the new season of The Apprentice, and I've never watched that show. It's with the show with Donald Trump, right? And, like, on this season, Meatloaf and the craziest of the crazies, Gary Busey, is on that show. And, man, he looks fucking crazy. He looks nutso, man. That guy, there are some loose wires up there. But it got me to thinking, like, you know, are these people just acting crazy because they kind of surpassed their due date, so to speak, on, you know, how relevant they are in Hollywood? Like, you know, like Randy Quaid, for instance, and his wife that went just, you know, balls to the wall insane and tried to defect to Canada because of the quote-unquote star whackers. Like, are people just doing this just to kind of, because, you know, as Americans, we're so, like, the new media now is all this reality TV and watching these train wrecks unfold, right? Like Celebrity Rehab or you know, all these, where they put them in the house, Celebrity Fit Club, you know, things like that. And we just watch this. We watch this stuff unfold every night. And so this is the new, like, it's making the new stars, right? That's how people are becoming famous now, is for being fucking insane. So are these people just, like, seeing an in and they're taking it? Like somebody like Gary Busey, who, you know, you'd think, like if that person was in your family, like, you'd get them help, right? You'd get them help and you'd make sure that they were okay and everything like that. But nobody's really doing that. They just keep on putting them on TV. Like, so is this all an act? Is the American people being had? Are we being had by this? I think that's a relevant question here, people. I think we stop paying attention to this crap and it'll go away. It will just go away. Like your parents always told you. Like, don't pay attention. Don't pay attention to the bully that's calling you airhead all the time, or pushing you down in the dirt, or throwing his rotten milk at your backpack, or pouring cologne all over your head on the bus. Don't pay attention to it, and it'll just go away. Right, Mom. Anyway, let's take our first musical break here. We are going to, let's see, Dismemberment Plan. We are featuring music from the Dismemberment Plan today. And I wanted to do, I originally thought I was going to do all songs from Emergency and I. But this is a really, really good song off of their album Change. It's called The Face of the Earth, and this is the Dismemberment Plan. And when we come back, we are going to talk really quick about this crazy accident that I saw the other day on the interstate. A new flavor of ice cream that I will never, ever, ever try. Okay, this is the Dismemberment Plan, The Face of Earth, of the Earth, off of the album Change, and we will be right back.
face of the earth. To the earth.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Air Raid Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. And you know what? I forgot to apologize for the past, like, three episodes. We've been having a serious background noise issue because I have acquired some new equipment. Because we're ramping it up. We're ramping it up, people. We're making this thing a real thing. And, yeah. But, you know, I know nothing about sound equipment, so I have no idea how to make it sound better. But I think I got it. So, anyway, yeah, that's what happened in the last, like, couple episodes that we were using the new equipment. So I apologize for that. Anyway, we are back. I hope you enjoyed that song as much as I did. I love the Dismemberment Plan. One of my favorite... favorite bands of all time. So the other day I was driving down Interstate 5 here in Seattle, going down to pick up a new piece of equipment that I'm using right now, the new fancy microphone that I have, Neiman. I don't know how you say it. Anyway, I was going down to the post office to pick this fucker up, and on my way down there, traffic is running, you know, fairly smooth. Nothing is really happening. And then all of a sudden, when I come around this corner, this bus in front of me slows down really quickly. And so, of course, I have to step on the brakes. And we come around this corner very, very slow, just creeping around this corner. I'm like, what the fuck? Because, you know, it's one of those instances where all the traffic in the rest of the interstate, the rest of the highway is going normal speed, but your lane is slowed down. And I'm like, okay, who's the asshole that is talking on their cell phone or texting or something while they're on the highway and just, like, you know, doesn't even know that they're going too slow. So we get around the corner, and there's this big, like container truck that's just, like, smoldering steam out of the top of it, right? And then there's two cars behind it that are just totally crunched. And so I'm like, oh my God, this car, that tanker's on fire, right? And then as we get closer, I notice that it was, like, just steam and stuff like that. And I look at the tank, and it says liquid nitrogen in big letters on the side of the truck. I'm like, oh my God. And visions of Terminator 2 flashed before my eyes. I thought I was going to see the coolest shit ever. Like, that's it. That's, like, one of the trucks that you avoid hitting on the highway. Like, you see a big truck, like a container truck like that, where it's carrying something in it, and especially if it has that little fucking, the flag on it, whatever color it is, you know it's bad. It's like, this is the truck you want to stay away from. But no, two cars hit it. And the thing was, like, you know, billowing out, like, liquid nitrogen into the air. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. I passed it without incident. There were no frozen cops, like, standing in the middle of the road. I didn't have to, like, jump kick anybody and shatter them into a million pieces, which would have been rad. You know, the scene from Demolition Man comes to mind. Wesley Snipes, Sylvester Stallone. Anyway, that's my liquid nitrogen story on the interstate. I had one more thing that I wanted to talk about before we get to this our air raid headline this week. The subject of work emails. The office that I work in, I work with a lot of different people. There are some people that like Obama, like myself, and there are some people that think he is Hitler, like some other people. And I get these emails from people, very patriotic emails. I'm sure a lot of you out there get these same things. And a lot of the times they are pretty nondescript. You know, they're just like these PowerPoint, like Microsoft PowerPoint slideshows of very patriotic things. Or, you know, not even patriotic things. So I got one a couple weeks ago that was about this, like, Chinese fortune teller, and you have to, like, send it to 20 people or it won't work for you. Bullshit. Fucking bullshit. I hate getting these things because, you know, people are like, well, I think it's bullshit, but I better just do it anyway, just to be on the safe side. Come on. Get it? Ah! Seriously. Seriously. Stop sending me these emails. Stop sending these emails, period. You don't have to worry about that kind of stuff, people. It's not going to do anything. It's not going to give you bad luck. It's on the internet. It's on the internet. Okay? Now, you know, letting a black cat cross your path or shattering a mirror, you know, those are real things. They're malleable. You can touch them. Jury's still out on that stuff. But stuff on the internet, not going to give you bad luck. Seriously. There is no way that you can hex an email. I'm stating that right now. I'm putting that down in the books. You put that down in the air raid logbook. Aaron told you that you cannot hex an email. That is impossible because it is only information. You cannot hex it. It is not a solid thing. It's not malleable. You cannot touch it. Okay? Anyway. So we get these work emails, like the one I was talking about. So, you know, it's like this this chain mail thing that you have to send to 20 people or it won't work. You know, you won't make your fortune, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, you know, it says some, like, super duper conservative political quip. Like, you know, Obama hates Jewish people, or Obama hates, you know, Asian people. Or Obama hates white people. Usually it's Obama hates white people because it's usually white people that are really afraid of Obama. And that was a sweeping generalization, by the way. But anyway, so we get, I just keep on constantly getting these emails. So the latest one that I got from a guy at work was just pictures of this new prototype jet. Right, that the Navy is using, and the jet is parked on this big aircraft carrier and stuff, and then there's all these scenes of, like, all these planes flying in formation, like all these planes that you wouldn't really normally see together, because one of them's a stealth fighter, and stealth fighters, you know, that's how stealth fighters work, is that they stay alone because they're stealth. You don't want a bunch of other jet fighters flying along with a stealth fighter, because then you can see the stealth fighter, right? The stealth bomber, or whatever it is. Like, that's not how stealth works. You stay away from other people, so you're not detectable by radar. Anyway, so there's a bunch of these scenes, right? And there's the one that they key in on is this big prototype, FA-18, or whatever it was called in the email. And so I'm looking at this thing, and I say, man, I have seen that thing before. Where have I seen that? That looks really familiar. And it looks really cool. I mean, it looks real and everything like that. And then they show the picture of the pilot. And I sit back in my chair and I go, yep, that makes total sense. The pilot, Lieutenant Kara Wade, Ringing a bell, anybody? Ringing a bell out there? Have you ever seen a movie called Stealth with Jessica Biel and Jamie Foxx? Kara Wade is the Oh my God. The character that Jessica Biel plays in the movie Stealth is Lieutenant Kara Wade. And there is a picture of Kara Wade, played by Jessica Biel, in the cockpit of this fake Hollywood jet. And so I shot an email off, you know, and then I noticed, I was like, oh my God, all of these pictures are from the movie Stealth, including the pictures of like this big brand new boat that they made out of, you know, the World Trade Center steel, you know, or some of it was made out of the World Trade Center steel. So I shoot this email off back to the guy who sent it to me, and I say, you know this is fake, right? You know this is fake. You have to, because like a guy like that, you know that they like that movie Stealth, or the guy that I'm thinking of. I haven't really explained the guy because I don't feel right doing that. I'm just ranting here, people. I'm just ranting. So if the guy who did send me that email hears this, I apologize. I'm just ranting. But anyway, I get up and I go over to this guy and I go, dude, this is in addition to sending him an email telling him that it's fake. And I say, hey, you know those pictures aren't real, man. And he's like, what are you talking about? They had more than one. And I'm just racking my brain, like, what's the reasoning behind that? What makes that, you know, how does that make these pictures real if there's more than one of them? Anyway, I just had to rant a little bit. And finally, I convinced him that it was from a movie, even though he didn't want to believe it. Even though, you know, Jessica Biel was right there. You know, God, I just don't get it. I don't get it. I'm lost. I am at a loss as to what that does to help patriotism by sending fake chain slideshow emails to people. I don't know. Because, of course, at the end of this email, right, it says something that's, you know, conservative in nature and you know, pissing on liberalism and Democrats and the president. You know, I can't remember what it said specifically, but that's what it did at the end of the email. And I don't understand what that does for anybody. Like what, like, you know, you're making yourself look like a moron. That's what you're doing. You're making, like, if you really have conservative values, if you are a true Republican, which I don't care. I don't care what side of the fence you're on. You know, people are entitled to their beliefs. That's what makes this country great, right? Is that you can think whatever you want, except when it, you know, harms somebody else. So I don't care about that. I don't care. But why, what does that do when you send stuff like that to people? I mean, damning them for their beliefs, right? You're just being a hypocrite. You're being a hypocrite because, you know, it goes back and forth. Whatever. I think in the first episode of Air Raid, I said I wasn't going to talk about politics because many people have called me an idiot savant without the savant parts when it comes to politics. So that is enough of that. I'm going to stop talking about it. Let's get to our headline here, people. And let's see if I can, find this sound drop. Here it is. Okay, Air Raid headlines for episode 36. Here we go. So I told you a little bit earlier, there's a new flavor of ice cream out there that I am never going to try. This is this sounds very, very gross. And I don't know what the shit people are thinking about this. Let's pull this up. Breast milk ice cream. Breast milk ice cream. You heard me correctly. Breast milk ice cream.
Are you off your fucking meds or something?
No. But you know what? All of Britain might be, because that's where this is coming from. It's a place, an ice cream vendor in London is selling this stuff And they started selling it on Friday, apparently. Naming the ice cream Baby Gaga. You know, after, of course, the pop icon Lady Gaga. You could only have something this weird because, you know, she's a weirdo, I guess. Whatever. But this just strikes me as a little bit crazy, of course. And I think that that's why they're doing it, you know. The economy is not that great over in London either, as well as over here in the Americas. So maybe they're just doing it to get attention, which is probably what they are doing, because nobody in their right mind would really eat this stuff, right? Wrong. They sold out. They sold out of the breast milk. Did I specify? This is human breast milk? Did I specify that? This is human breast milk from female humans. And they're selling it at $1.61 per fluid ounce, which is quite expensive for this. Let's see, it says here, mothers who produce the milk are screened as closely as blood donors, and the flavor of their milk can vary considerably. That's so gross. I don't even want to think about it. When I first heard this story, too, like, I felt sick to my stomach. I actually felt sick to my stomach. And this goes back to, like, you know, Mireta's pregnant. I'm going to be a father soon. And we had this discussion a little while back about, like, you know, would I taste the breast milk? And I really didn't want to. Like, I don't want to. I really don't. Like, that's not something that I'm interested in. And for some reason, it makes me kind of queasy a little bit, even just talking about it. Oh, but apparently they used, like, 15 different women. Screen them, and then, you know, added like vanilla and some other flavorings to the ice cream. Oh God, that's so gross. Oh, so it says here, it says $1.61 per fluid ounce. Let's see. Oh, it says down here in the article, the proprietors say that human breast milk is thinner and sweeter than cow's milk and are treating it as a gourmet delicacy, which explains the much higher price. So basically, per serving of this stuff, it's like $22 per serving. Ugh. And so I imagine, like, you know, a cup of this ice cream is like $22. Who in their right mind would buy this stuff? Why? Why? Oh, gross. Oh, my God. I'm a little lightheaded right now. I don't know how much longer I can talk about this. Maybe this wasn't a good idea, having this as a headline this weekend for this week's episode. I just can't hang with it. Anyway, you know what? That's enough. I'm not gonna even talk about it anymore, because it's actually making me a little bit queasy. And I don't get queasy a lot, like talking about gross stuff. Like, I just told you guys at the beginning of the show, like, I love some gore. Like, I love gory, stupid, campy movies, and I can watch that stuff all day. Like, we watched Human Centipede the other week with some friends, and we ate pizza while we watched it. Like, it didn't bother me at all. Even there's this scene where, like, this woman's face gets all infected and stuff, and they're, like, pressing the pus. See, I'm getting gross again. I don't know why I went down this road again. Anyway. Whatever. Hey, let's go to our second musical break here, and then after that we're gonna bring Alex, or that's the second time I messed that up, Eric Axelson, on from the Dismemberment Plan, and talk with him about the new tour that they're on, and the re-release of Emergency and I. And I hope he doesn't listen to this episode, because we just went from talking about breast milk ice cream to infections in the face from Human Centipede. And now we're going to go straight into this interview with Eric Axelson. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And we will be back in just a moment. But first, let us say a quick word for our friends down at Varellen Amplifiers. Varellen Amplifiers is a local Seattle-based amplifier company. They make guitar and bass amps for all you really, really loud, really good musicians. Let me tell you, I have one of these amps, and it's up in my living room right now. I'm actually looking at it. It's the first custom amp that I've ever had made for me. And man, this thing is going to stay with me till the day I die. It is so nice. And Ben down there at the shop, anything goes wrong with your amp, he'll fix it. You know, and they're just great to work with. So check them out. Check them out. Varellen Amplifier. You can go to our web-raid.net and scroll down on the left-hand side of the page, and you can see a Varellen Amplifiers button. Click that. Go straight to their website and enjoy. So VarellenAmplifiers.com, the only amp you will ever need. So don't forget the bass, because I know that I do belong here. Go down the checklist, let's see if feelings are good. This honesty is bad, and keeping it inside is worse still. You want a problem, well, I guess we got one now. I really don't know how, this season's over every goddamn. We are joined here by Eric Axelson. I'm sorry about butchering that already. Right out of the gate, I already messed something up. From the Dismemberment Plan. How's it going, dude?
It's going good. This is our first weekend without shows or without all day practice, I think, since the New Year. So it's strange to be home. Yeah, it's my first day without my first weekend without a playing guys around. It's kind of strange.
That's pretty cool, man. So it's your first day off, and you have to call into a podcast over in Seattle.
Yeah, such a pain in the ass.
I know. That's kind
of there's some of our Seattle show coming up, so you know, we're still fan active.
Right. Yeah, totally. So you said the weather has been quite nice over there in D.C. right now, huh?
Yeah, it's amazing. We've had a really cold winter, and we've had a decent amount of snow and ice. And today it's 60-something, so, you know, we're doing some yard work, opening the windows up. So it's been a good first day off.
Right. Now, is Mrs. Obama helping you out in the garden today?
She's not. They're a couple miles from here, so we don't trade tools all that often. But I do have a dream to go visit her garden at one point. She had a big old garden in my backyard. And theirs is bigger, you know, not the size matters. But I want to go check out the White House garden and see what they're growing.
Right. I would imagine that the White House garden is probably, you know, my bathroom could fit in their carrot patch.
Probably. Yeah, I haven't been there, but my understanding is pretty big, and I know she works on it, but I think also the staff, who it's their job to make sure, like, the weeds are pulled and things are going okay.
Right.
You know, if I'm gone for a week and I go out there and I haven't pulled weeds or watered, you know, I pay for it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, if only I had White House staff to come here and keep my stuff going, but, you know.
Well, you just, hey, man, you keep on trying, dude. You keep on, you reach for that dream, and when you see the chance, you take it, my friend.
Right, and maybe Obama hears this interview, and she goes, oh, I'm going to go out there in the garden, and suddenly you'll get a knock at the door.
Right. Well, they are huge fans of the Air Raid podcast, so, yeah.
Oh, good to hear.
yeah. They might actually be pissed that we're talking about them, because I told them personally that I would never talk about them, but, you know, whatever.
We'll fix it in the edit.
Yeah, totally. So you guys kind of are, well, not kind of, you guys have re-released Emergency and I on vinyl on the local record label Barsook here recently. And you guys are doing kind of this reunion tour that you've apparently been on for how long? How long you guys been touring now?
Well, it's not been quite a tour. It's been more like weekends because we've all been doing our jobs around the show. So we did a secret show on January 15th, just to kind of have a warm up before we hit the bigger clubs. And pretty much every weekend since then, there's been shows. You know, we did a weekend in D.C. We did a weekend of New York, Boston, Philly. We did 10 days in Japan, so that was two weekends, and then we did a weekend in Chicago, and then we're back home now. But actually Jason's other band is out for the next two weekends. So yeah, poor Jason's been home for 3 days and then got back in a band. Uh-huh. And he's up, they did New York, Boston, and D.C. this weekend, and then they're in Chicago, Cleveland, and Detroit next weekend, and then he's going to Seattle. So
nice.
He's got nonstop shows.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, though. I mean, you've been kind of involved with music ever since the band, the Dismemberment Plan kind of disbanded in, what was it, 2003?
Yeah, three. I mean, more or less. I mean, there's been small gaps here and there, but I've been pretty active musically since then. I think everyone has for the most part.
Right.
But, I mean, Jason's current band, Poor But Sexy, I think started maybe 2005, so I think he had a couple of years where he wasn't playing as much, but then it started to pick up a little bit. And then I was in Maritime for a couple of years, and then when I left Maritime and quit touring, Jill and I had a band called Stated for a couple of years, and then since Stated, I've been doing a little percussion work with Jason's band. We're not really a member, but when they play in the area, you know, I play congas and shakers and cowbells and all the
accessory
crap, which is fun. Yeah, it's good friends and it's great music, so it's a good time.
Right. So let's kind of go back to how the Dismemberment Plan kind of got started. You guys all met in high school, right?
Not all of us. Travis and I went to high school together. I was playing in a band called the Milk Carton Children, and he was friends with our guitar player. So when we played shows, like in people's basements, he'd be there, and we kind of met in passing a couple times. And I think, you know, over the first year or so of college, I'd see him over the summer. So we kind of just stayed in touch, and we had similar music tastes. And then I met Jason, like, the second day of college.
Oh, okay.
Because he was dating a friend of mine from high school. So we started talking, and then eventually Travis and Jason met through me in college. And it wasn't until, I guess it was New Year's Day of my senior year, we had our first practice. And that was before we even knew Joe. That was my brother-in-law. He was playing drums. So we started, in 93 on New Year's Day, and then, you know, things kind of slowly picked up over the years. And then right before the first record, Steve left the band because he didn't want to tour. And we met Joe through a band that we knew in town.
Oh, nice, nice. And so, because you guys, was the first label that you guys were on, was that Interscope?
Uh-uh.
No?
No, I mean, technically we did a 7-inch on pink vinyl, of all things.
Right.
In 94 on a label called Alto, which is essentially three friends from college doing a label out of their house.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And then we moved back to D.C. after I graduated, and we were, you know, building up enough songs for a record and trying to find a label. And Javier DeSoto, which was Kim from Jawbox's label, so DeSoto put out our first two records and a 7-inch. And then after the second record, we were on tour and we met the folks from Interscope. So Interscope signed us before Bernsey and I. But then, you know, the catch is, I mean, you may know this already, but we recorded the record with Interscope's money.
Right,
and they were planning on releasing it. They did an EP while they were waiting to do the full length. And in that process, went through that big merger. We had dropped, and then DeSoto picked it up and released it. So
yeah,
you know, we were in Interscope maybe for like 10 months.
And you guys kind of like fell through the cracks on that one too, because you didn't end up being in debt to Interscope for that recording.
Yeah, well,
right.
The way the contract was written was it was a two record deal with options. So contractually, they had to pay us to record X amount of records if they released them or not. And then they had the rights to those records. So the way it went down was, like, when the merger happened, it was four big labels came together, and they had a ton of bands. And we couldn't really get them on the phone, but what we were hearing from friends in the business was, like, they have these big, long meetings where they sit there and, like, cut bands from the roster. There was, like, a point system, but, you know, this big band they clearly hold on to, you know, like U2 or, like, Bonnie Raitt. And then I'm sure there's bands in the middle that they probably thought maybe worth something, you know, like someone like Amy Mann or someone like, I don't know, Darden Smith, like someone who actually had some sort of name to them. And we were still kind of a small DC punk band that no one really knew. So
right,
in a lot
right.
of ways, it wasn't worth their time to give us a hard time. It wasn't really worth their time to make us, you know, try to buy it back. You know, and to be honest, like the budget we did the record for, like indie standards was huge. It was $50,000. But by major label standards, it was tiny.
Totally.
You know, it's like 20th of what they pay other bands to do.
Yeah.
So I think for them, it was like, you know what, it's be more expensive to have the lawyers, you know, do hours to deal with this. So just take it.
Yeah, totally.
And it paid us for the second record. We got another 50 for the record we didn't make for them.
Yeah.
So,
well, you guys weren't, you definitely weren't dealing with Bonnie Raitt money then, huh?
No. And the thing is, I think people forget that when the record came out, like, you know, people liked us. We weren't that big. Like, we were still playing to maybe like 100 people a night when Emerging Night came out. Even like after a year of touring on the record, we'd still hit a lot of towns and play to maybe anywhere from like 75 to 200 people. It wasn't like we were suddenly this big band. It was just a record
that
the critics liked a lot.
Yeah. And you're talking about Emergency and I right now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So when that came out, it was definitely a slow burn before we hit a point where we actually had a solid fan base.
Yeah. And how did? I mean, I'm always curious about that because I've played in bands in the past and stuff, and you know, never. I think the biggest show that I've ever played was like for 100 people, which was still like mind blowing for me. You know, it always like felt really good. Like you get up on stage and there's actually people there to see you. Even if most of them are like friends, but I always wonder about that. Like with bands that have done pretty well in the past and have like gone on tour and stuff like that. Like, was that just at that age when you guys started going on tour and when Emergency and I, like even just like reading critics' reviews of the record, was that just like mind blowing for you or what?
I mean, it was totally a slow process. I mean, if you're about the third record, we already had two full records of reviews. So we'd already you know, we hadn't been in, you know, Rolling Stone, but we had enough press from the Veins and, you know, some smaller glossies like Alternative Press, you know, or Magnet had mentioned us. To be fair, the first time I heard us on the radio in D.C., you know, I started like running around the house and trying to find everyone I could to turn the radio on.
Right.
For the first time, you're in a glossy or the first time you're in like a local paper, you know, you cut it out. And it's so exciting to see, but I think, I mean, it was a slow process. It wasn't like, you know, overnight suddenly we had press and beforehand we didn't.
Right. So you're slowly just kind of acclimating to what's going on around you then, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like with the shows, I mean, you know, I have a list somewhere of all of our Black Cat shows, which is the, you know, the local club in D.C. we played at.
Uh-huh.
And it shows kind of like the slow growth where it was like we played their opening for one band and there was 100 people there. And then we played their headlining and it was 25. And then we came back and it was 60. And over the course of, you know, 4 or 5 years before we hit a point where we actually sold it out. So, you know, it was definitely a process of playing and playing and playing. I do remember being at a show like for the first time where there's people in the crowd we didn't know. And that was a cool feeling. Like people coming up to talk to me and being like, oh, who in the band do you know? And they're like, oh, we don't know anybody. And being kind of shocked that they were just there because they liked the band.
Right.
You know, well, the first time someone wants you to autograph something, you think like they're fucking with you and you're like, what? Okay.
You want my signature on something, huh?
Right, and then you feel bad because you realize that they're sincere and they're just being, you know, they're psyched about your band. You're like, oh, I'm sorry, man. Yeah, I'll totally sign that.
Right. Yeah, totally. And then you don't want to be a dick, right? So you just,
But it takes a while. It's a weird thing. Like, if you've never had someone ask you to sign something for an autograph, like, it feels kind of gauche. Like, you feel kind of weird doing it or kind of like you're being a rock star doing it. But at the same time, like the thing, and you played in bands, you know this too. Like, have you ever had a night where you've had a show where you feel like you didn't play that well, but then people come up to you and be like, hey, great show. And
for
a while, we'd be like, oh, wasn't that great? And you realize it's not cool to say it. Like, if someone thinks you had a good show, like, that's their perception, that's fine.
Right,
you don't need
to
let them know how bad you played.
That's really interesting that you say that too, because, like, that has happened to me in the past also. I haven't played live for a long time, actually, now, but... Yeah, it has happened in the past, and you always feel like, oh, they're just fucking with me right now, or they're just saying that to be nice.
Right, or you want to let them know that you know that it wasn't that good. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like, that's not your place to let them know, you know, that they're wrong. You're just like, oh, okay, cool.
Thank you
for coming. Thanks for doing
that. Yeah.
It takes practice.
Yeah, totally. So back to this whole, like, meeting in high school, and then, because you guys were together for a good 10 years, right? From 93 to 2003?
Yeah, and New Year's Day 93 was our first practice, and then our last show was September 1st, 2003.
Wait, New Year's Eve was your first practice?
New Year's Day.
Oh, New Year's Day. Okay. And you weren't too hungover to go and play some music, huh?
Nah, we were fine. I'm sure we were hurting a little bit. I mean, at that point, I would have been 22, and... Yeah, Travis was probably 21. Like, we were young.
Yeah.
But, you know, sure, you know, we were fine enough to play.
Well, I guess that's a sign of a true musician then, right?
Maybe, or just we were resilient, or maybe we drank enough water.
right. Took some vitamin B the night before or something.
But that was the start, It started, you know, we were in college and, you know, got together and started messing around. And it never occurred to us that it would be a career one day, you know. It was always just
right.
It was just fun to hang out and write songs.
Yeah, totally. Did you guys get along for the time that you guys were together too?
It's a band, so, you know, there's going to be ups and downs, like any relationship. In general, like, we always hung out. Like, you know, when we weren't at shows, we'd go to the same bars and do a lot of the same stuff. It's different now, mainly just because of where we are in life and where we all live. Like, you know, at this point, there's babies and mortgages and,
right,
you know, people move to different parts of the city, so we, you know, have different schedules, so it's not, you know, we don't hang out as much just because of logistics.
Right. Yeah, but that's another thing that always kind of interests me, too, about bands that have been together for a really long time, is, like, how the band dynamic works, you know, when they go on tour and stuff like that. I don't know, it's just something that always, like, grabs my attention, especially now that I've seen the that Pixies documentary, you know, Loud, Quiet, Loud. Have you seen that?
I know, is it good?
It is very, very good. But they, like, I think they all, I seem to remember they all take, like, separate tour buses on their, like, on their reunion tour, you know, just because there's no communication whatsoever, you know, that went on with that band. And just, like, I don't know, just the band dynamic thing is always really interesting, I think, for people to kind of
hear
about.
I think also with bands who are bigger and older, that happens. Like, I hear stories about that, about, like, the Eagles and how a lot of them are in different vehicles and they just meet on stage.
Right, yeah.
But I guess, I mean, at some point, if you're a band that's that big, if it's that lucrative to do what you're doing, then you put aside your differences to play the shows, and then you just realize, like, okay, this is how we can work together without killing each other. We don't need to be friends. We can just be on stage.
Or it just becomes, and, becomes an actual job instead of something that you're, like, a labor of love, you know?
Yeah, and if you're the Eagles, you're making a shitload of money. You know? You're making a shitload of money, so it's probably fine, you know? I mean, if it's that or go do computer programming, it may be a lot more fun to go on tour and see your friends and make a shitload of money and hang out in your own bus.
Totally.
But no, we were all in the same band on these tours. You know, the only time we were split up was flying to Japan. Travis is from New York, so he's on a different plane than we were. You know, but, you know, we're flying economy. It's not like we're flying on four separate jets or something.
Wait, what? Barsuk didn't pay for that?
Yeah, no, serious. Damn, indie rock.
Yeah, I know. Somebody needs to have a talk with those guys, I guess.
No, Josh.
What transpired in 2003 for you guys to kind of decide to call it quits?
There's a couple things. Part of it was we've been touring a lot, and not everyone was as excited to keep touring.
Right.
And I think the bigger problem was the writing wasn't clicking as well anymore. Like, we were still writing songs, so we had maybe six songs, maybe seven towards the new record. But it was a lot more of a process. Like, it was more like we were, you know, to me it felt like we were, like, kind of crossing off songs as we finished them versus, like, in the day we would write songs and it was this very celebratory thing versus, like, a, you know, it didn't seem like work then, and it seemed like we kind of felt, I don't know, like, the writing felt a little more stilted. And, you know, when we sat down and talked about it, like, we don't want to put out a record if we're not all, you know, in love with the music we're playing.
Right.
You know, that way for the first four records, and just, like, you know, too many bands keep doing it longer than they have to because they can, not because they want to.
Yeah, and that's really true, too. Like, you can listen to a band that's been together forever that started out with a really strong album, and you just kind of hear it kind of fizzle out as time goes on, too, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of where we're at. It's like, you know, we could put another record out, and it would definitely, you know, it would make money, and we could tour and make money, and it would be a job, but it's just, like, at the end of the day, you want to feel good about what you're doing and make sure everyone feels good about it and not just, you know, it'll launch their eyes.
Right.
And that's, you know, that went down. It wasn't like, and again, it wasn't that we couldn't hang out. I mean, in the 4 years after that, Jason produced Travis's second record. He produced the Stated record. You know, people cross-pollinated musical things together. So it wasn't like we weren't friends. It was just like it wasn't clicking in the foursome.
Right. I think that's a very amicable way to end things in a band, too. Instead of just screaming,
you know, it's a hard decision. Like, it'd be easier if we were fighting or if there was some sort of, like, you know, tangible, like, we can't get past this. It's just like, well, you know,
right.
Be true to it. So, yeah.
Well, for one thing, it'd be a much better story.
Right. It's less fun to be like, well, it didn't work anymore, so we just stopped.
Yeah.
But, you know. Is what it is.
Yeah. And then you kind of, everybody kind of went off their own ways. You actually went on to form a band with some of the guys from The Promise Ring, right?
Yeah. It was, I mean, we announced that the promo was wrapping up, and about a week later I got an email from Dan Didier saying, hey, sorry about the news, but what are you doing afterwards?
Yeah.
And at that point, they were still kind of in project mode, but they wanted someone to write bass lines and record with them. And I initially wasn't going to join the band, but after going to Milwaukee a couple times, and we really kind of hit it off, you know, I joined. Because, I mean, for me, like, at the time, like, the music didn't sound like anything I'd played before. Like, it was a lot more straight up, a lot more pop than, I guess, the plan was doing.
Right.
Kind of hard. I kind of had to, like, change how I played. But, again, like, the guys were fantastic, and I liked the songs, and it just, you know, became a band.
Right. And that was Maritime, correct?
Correct, yep.
Right.
Yep.
And they're playing with you guys in Chicago?
They did last weekend.
Oh, okay, that was last weekend, yeah. And were you playing, you're not playing with them still,
friends.
Right?
Yeah, it's got to the point where we've been on tour for a couple of years and put out two records, and at that point, God, I was 34, I want to say, and I kind of got to the point where we weren't really making money, and a lot of the places we were playing kind of felt like adventures I'd had before.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
It was great to hang out with the guys, but it wasn't really like a... it didn't feel very life-affirming, I guess. We're also tight, you know? I mean, it was great to see him in Chicago, and I still talk to the guys, and they send me tracks when they write new songs so I can listen to them. And,
oh, cool. Yeah. So, wait, were you... Yeah. I, I don't know if I missed this or not, but were you playing with them at the Chicago show?
No. They're the new bass player, Justin Klug. He used to be in a band called Decibel-y out of Milwaukee.
Okay.
It's funny because when they first sent me the first demo, it was like, hey, we have these 5 songs, check them out. And there's bass tracks on them. I'm like, well, who's that bass player? That's your guy.
Yeah.
Those are great bass parts for these songs. But he was taken in the band at the time, so, you know, so I was the guy. But when I left, like, they asked him and he was available, and it was kind of, you know, the ideal fit. He lived in town. They're all good friends. And I think his style fits what they do a lot more, too. So
nice.
It was kind
nice.
Of win-win for everybody.
Cool. And then you went on from Maritime, you went on and joined a band called Statehood, right?
Yeah, we had a friend named Clark who had a bunch of songs he'd written on MPC, and he wanted to do stuff with a live band. And I'd been on tour with Maritime, and Joe emailed me because Joe had played drums at a party where Clark played guitar and sang, and Joe played drums. And I said, you know, when you come back, maybe let's see what happens in the basement. So that was also a good fit. And we'd known Clark for years, and he's a good friend of ours.
Cool.
So we did a record in 2006, I want to say, 2007, and didn't really tour so much on it. We did more like weekends just because of our lives. I mean, I was a high school teacher at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then we were working on a second record, and at that point, Clark had been diagnosed with melanoma.
Right, I read about that, yeah.
Yeah, and he had gone through some surgery where the doctors thought they cleared it all out, and he was cancer-free. And then the fall of 08, he got in for another checkup, and they found a whole bunch of stuff in his lungs.
Wow.
And actually, we were on the road at that point. He got the call when we were at a hotel in Cleveland, and it was pretty devastating. And then he kept getting treatment, and we kept playing shows, but then it got to the point where he couldn't play by, like, March of 09, and then in May we got the news that it was terminal. So,
man, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear about that, man.
It's pretty rough. I mean, it's... you know, when you start playing in bands when you're in high school, you don't really consider things like losing band members to cancer when you're older.
Right, yeah. Well, you kind of have
that.
Yeah,
but I mean, in some ways, it's the reality, you know.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You get older
yeah.
and lose friends.
Yeah, totally. I mean, do you have that when you look back to when you were touring, you know, at a younger age and stuff like that and starting bands in high school and going on to college and stuff like that? I mean, you almost have that sense of invincibility. Right? Because, like, you're traveling
totally, yeah.
from
I mean,
place to place.
Yeah,
and...
like early tours especially. Like, you're on the road, and you're traveling across America with your friends, and it's like, you know, everything feels possible because it's, you know, it's almost like a Kerouac feeling, like you're driving across the desert
right.
with your boys, and you're going to play a show, and, you know, you're kind of fighting the hardships together.
Yeah, yeah. And then reality hits you real hard sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, even aside from, like, Clark's passing, it's like we're at an age now where people have mortgages and babies, and we... work practice around nap time and it's,
right.
You know, and it's just kind of the reality. Like, if you want to keep playing music when you're older, like, these things can happen, you know. So we have a lot of friends who stopped playing in bands in their 20s and, you know, didn't deal with the, I guess, adulthood and band life. But it's kind of, you know, I think anyone you talk to who's in their 30s or 40s playing music is like, where are you at, you know?
yeah, totally. So do you have babies yourself?
I don't. I do not. Joe is all alone with a baby.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Gonna happen anytime soon there, bud?
I don't know, but we'll see. I'm not against the idea.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
hasn't happened.
right. So I also did a little reading, you know, to prepare myself. I don't usually I'm really very bad at preparing. So I'm sorry if this interview has just been, you know, a pain in your butt today.
Torture.
But yeah, it sounds like it, right?
Yeah.
But I did read something a little bit earlier today before you called in about you having this amazing memory.
I used to. It's not as good as it used to be.
Not as good. Okay.
It's still pretty good. Like the way it was, like back when we toured, we'd run into people, and I remember like where we'd met or what we'd been doing or the, you know, who was on the bill that night or what we had for dinner. And it was crazy. Like it was like this Rain Man party trick. My theory is that when I started teaching high school, like you have to get so much other knowledge in your brain, not just like content to teach, but like remembering kids' names and parents' names and, you know, all these essays you're grading. And I feel like I lost some of it, but it's still pretty good. We met some people at these shows that I pulled some stuff out of my ass that I remember from like 99 or whatever we'd met.
Right. Yeah, it sounded like a lot of people too. Like it became almost like a party trick or something like that on some of your tours.
Yeah, kind of, where people would be like, oh, yeah, so, I mean, the one prime example was we were talking, we were up at Joe's house before when we were planning the shows, and for whatever reason, we were trying to pull up, there was a party, that it was someone's birthday party we had played at, and I think it was maybe a party where Joe had met his girlfriend or something, or something like that, and we're sitting around, and I was like, oh, yeah, that was, that was like January 24th, right? And Ryan Nelson DJed, and this is like, you didn't know that. And then Joe pulled up our database, and it was the right day of the week, you know, like right, all the details are right. I'm like, I don't know.
You could make money off that, man. You could.
I mean, part of it is because I'm pretty good with dates. So, you know, for that one, I'm pretty sure I thought for a second when that tour, that was our first headlining tour for Emergency, and I remember like where the first day was and what day of the week it was for whatever reason, and I can kind of just backtrack there.
Yeah,
so a lot of it's just that being like, you know, I remember the replay, you know, I remember a DC show with Def Cab was on, you know, the 12th of March, but I remember that because we'd been in Boston for St. Patrick's Day on the 17th, and we did 2 days there and two in New York and one in Philly. You know, and some of it's kind of that where you just kind of do the math.
Right. Yeah, totally. I usually have a pretty good, I have super good face recognition. Like, uh-huh. I can't remember people's names for the life of me, but like, and last night was actually a perfect example of this. A friend of mine's girlfriend is named Carolyn, but I was calling her Kathy all night. So I had to send a quick, like, apology email this morning to her, but... But I remember faces really, really well. And, like, I can just walk down the street and I'll be like, oh, that person went to my same college. Like, you know,
interesting.
9 years ago.
I haven't read it yet, but my girlfriend saved me a magazine article from the New York Times from last weekend about memory, which I didn't mean to read because I think it's fascinating why certain things we remember and some things we can't find our keys.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah. And it's usually like somebody that I've never even met before, but I can say like, oh, I saw that person like 2 years ago at this coffee stand downtown. You know, like I can pick that shit out. It's weird.
That's the one that faded for me more, like the face recognition I used to have of cold and that one slipped, but I still remember more dates and places. And I don't know, I remember in grad school for teaching, we were doing a class on ed psych, and we did an exercise where we got in pairs, and one was a teacher and one was a student, and we had to teach the other person to memorize a 50-digit number as far as they could.
Oh, wow.
And I think within like 15 minutes of our time to work on it, I got 43 numbers in, and by the end of the class, I had 50.
Damn, dude.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of it's just like patterns and how you chunk things in your brain.
Right. Or how you like assign value to it in your head, too. Like,
yeah, like you break it down into like phone numbers or zip codes or you picture it on a number pad or, you know, a lot of tricks.
Right. I think my cell phone is really dumbing me down in that respect, though.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All those numbers are saved. You have to think about it. I mean,
exactly.
I have the numbers, so I remember them.
Yeah. So are you still teaching then on the side?
No, I quit. I was a high school teacher for 3 years in D.C. public schools, and now I run the high school program for Rock the Vote.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so I get in the classroom sometimes, but not as often as I'd like to. It's still education on some level.
Yeah. Did you find it? My brother is a teacher, a special ed teacher here in the greater Seattle area, and man, he has some like really horrible stories, like. You know, about just a lot of them about like parents who don't give a rat's ass. You know, did you deal with that a lot too in teaching in the public school system over there?
It's definitely, I'm trying to think. I mean, I would say it's definitely the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, teaching's hard, let alone teaching in the inner city is really hard.
Right.
It wasn't just the parents. I mean, it's kind of a combination of everything. Like, if you're not ready for it, you know, when you sit in a class and, you know, you talk to a student who was like a block away when she heard the gunshot that killed her father, or, you know, the student who found out where her dad is and he's in jail and he's in a wheelchair and she's going to meet him for the first time next week. or kids whose parents abandoned them when they were three and left them with their uncle who was in a gang.
Right.
Like that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, the day-to-day of teaching, like being in class, keeping order, being organized and grading and all that is really, really tough. But then you factor in, like, the intangibles about the relationships and, being like a mentor and a parent figure to a lot of your students. And it's really hard. Like, it's definitely an emotionally exhausting job. So, I mean, your brother, especially, like, in special ed, like, a lot of those kids need so much help and they don't get it.
Right. Yeah.
But there's no easy answers. Like, there's not an easy solution. Like, the whole debate of education in America, people keep talking about it like there's, you do this and it fixes it, but it's so much, it deals with parents and teachers and the kids and the system and the money and...
Right.
It's complex.
Yeah. Let me ask you a quick question here, because this is something that I always ask my brother too, is like, do you think, because it's always, when they talk about it, when the talking heads are talking about it on the news and in the Capitol and stuff like that, they're always like, let's throw some more money at it. We need more money to throw at this. Do you see it as being like a money issue? Or is it more of just like, we all need to buck up and just kind of help these kids get through these things, instead of just plopping them in front of the TV it's got to be a combination of that kind of stuff. It is.
I mean, the money would help. I mean, there are cities you look at and the dollar per student is a lot lower than it is in a lot of the richer suburbs. And that's part of it.
Right.
Like how many teachers you have, how qualified are the teachers, how good are the resources.
How many kids are in the classroom itself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had a class of 33 kids.
Wow.
Which was pretty big. But I had friends teach classes of 40.
Jeez.
And I think in Fairfax County, I think the average class size is 22, which is, a pretty big difference.
Right.
It's probably too complex for a single conversation. But
right.
I mean, my first year in teaching in D.C., like, I think I read that 70 to 80% of schools had called in because of leaky roofs and not sufficient heat. Even on like that level, like being in a school, you're 15 and you're in a classroom that's freezing cold and the roof's dripping. Like, what part of you makes you think that, someone actually cares about you learning?
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. Yeah.
And some kids push through that. Some kids, they buck down and they get through it and they get to college. But, it's kind of a lot to ask someone who's in their formative years to kind of look past the inequities and, gang fights in the hallways or, lockers being lit on fire and, crazy shit like that. My school is pretty cool and pretty good by many standards.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of schools in D.C. it's brutal.
Yeah. Well, that was super depressing talk.
It's reality, I think it can get better. It's just it needs a lot of work and it needs a lot of prioritizing of what Americans want to get done.
Right. Yeah, totally. Well, let's get back to the album here. The re-release of Emergency and I on Barsook Records. And it's on vinyl, right? It's only on vinyl.
Yep. It's on double vinyl and it comes with a download code.
Oh, nice. And how did this all come about? How did this come up? Was it your guys' decision to try to re-release this, or did Barsook come to you guys?
Over the years, people have brought it up. This push came from our friend Josh from The Onion. He called me, and we had a long talk about trying to reissue it. And that got the wheels in motion this time. So we talked about it and, looked into redesigning the art for LP size and remastering the tapes so it would be straight analog.
Nice.
And it was kind of a long process, but that was how it started. And then we were thinking about putting it out. DeSoto wasn't really, we're not really an active label anymore. Like Kim still has catalog, but she doesn't release anything new.
Right.
So there's not much of a system in place anymore. And also, we wanted to do it in a very deluxe fashion. So we wanted to find a label who, would be putting something out that was going to be double vinyl, gatefold,
Right.
180
yeah.
LPs. And Barsook said they'd do it. So it was good timing, and they're friends of ours. We knew them from back in the day.
Uh-huh.
So it was a good fit.
Yeah, and they're a great label, man. Like they have a lot of really great acts signed on with them right now too.
Like the Globes.
Yeah. So are there any, you have any nerves coming up when you guys kind of got back together and started playing these shows again, or were you guys pretty prepared for it?
We were prepared. Like, we did a lot of time practicing.
Yeah.
We did a lot of hours making sure we came back at full strength. Like, I think we've all seen bands who reunited who hadn't done the time, who hadn't really
right,
learned the songs all the way or gotten back in shape. Not naming names. but we knew that, and we wanted to make sure that we came back full. And I think every show we played, we've heard comments in person and, you know, online afterwards at how it sounds like we haven't stopped. And that's good to hear. It's flattering that you know, all that practice paid off. But nerves, yeah, there were some nerves, which is why we did that secret show, because we were like, I want our first show to be on Jimmy Fallon.
Our
first show to you know, be able to kick out some cobwebs and play to some smiling faces and then, you know, get back to it. We played like 700, 800 shows, so we got a lot of practice, but, you know, we haven't done it for 7 years. You know?
Right. Yeah. And how was that show? Did it feel pretty good getting up on stage at the Jimmy Fallon show?
Yeah, well, it's kind of surreal because the way it's set up, like you're in the studio, you're to the left of where Jimmy and the guests are sitting.
Uh-huh.
And when you play, like, they let in about 50 or 70 fans in this kind of like bleachers around you.
Really?
But in front of you, like facing forward, there's a floor area that's maybe, I don't know, 50 or 70 feet. And in there's five cameras that are all on wheels that are moving around and taping you. So it's like the way you're looking, all you see is like all these red lights floating around because with the studio lights, you can't really see. So it's like these aliens are popping in and out. and then the crowds pass that. So it's like you have to do kind of a bit of a mind trick.
Yeah.
To think you're playing to the actual crowd.
Right. That's right. I remember now because I saw Sunny Day Real Estate played on Fallon when they were doing their reunion tour and yeah, they bring in a bunch of people like behind you, right?
Yep.
That's what you're talking about, like the bleachers? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that kind of weird?
It was only weird in that they weren't there until we played. So, you know, we sound checked and we blocked and we did all that stuff and then we went off and did our thing.
Yeah.
And then we're not allowed in the studio while they're shooting. Like, we're back in our dressing room the whole time while they're doing the show. So we're back there watching it on TV.
Right.
And then
right.
suddenly, you know, they tell us when we're set up and then we walk through a door to our gear. And then there's all these people around where our gear is. So it was a little, we knew it was going to happen, but it's still a little unnerving. Like, oh, hey, everybody.
Yeah. They're surrounding us. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a little bit, not unnerving, but just, you know, a little jarring. But again, at that point, we're all pretty cranked up and nervous for playing on TV. So.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool, man. And, Eric, it's been a huge pleasure to get to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking us on the show.
Oh, definitely. And we're really looking forward to seeing you guys March 12th here in Seattle at the Showbox Soto with Mount St. Helens Phenom Band and the Globes.
Yeah,
it's going to be awesome. I'm really looking forward to it because I kind of got into you guys a little bit late, and I think when I really got into... It's like Emergency and I was one of those albums that I put on repeat, and by repeat I mean I didn't take it out of the CD player for like a month. And
that's cool.
I think I really pissed off my roommates at that point too. But when I got into you guys, like you guys were just, you know, about to kind of break up, and so I never got to see you live. So this is going to be a real treat for me. So I'm really looking forward to it.
The show in 03.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Bummer.
That was we did a couple nights at the Crocodile at the Graceland back then.
Right. Yeah.
But it was kind of bad timing because it was the day after the drummer for Carp died in that awful accident, and it was just
Yeah,
and it was tragic because we got to town and everyone looked really glum. We're like, why is everyone so down here? It's the rain. And like, no, someone had passed away. And we're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know, we thought about canceling the show, and the club was like, no. I mean, you know. Not everybody knew him. He should play the show, and you know they'd want you to keep playing the show.
Right.
We didn't know him or the guys in his band at all. But it was one of those things where it just felt weird to be playing when everyone at the club just lost a friend.
Right. Yeah.
But it definitely was a hard couple of days to be playing.
Yeah, and there comes the reality part again.
Yeah, again, yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you don't expect. And it's the last thing you expect to hear when you fall into a club, and you're just like, oh, Jesus. You know,
yeah,
it's very tragic.
No kidding. No kidding.
But,
well, yeah, Eric, so, I'll let you get back to your gardening.
Okay.
Today.
And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah. I'll see you guys in a couple weeks, and hopefully get to meet you in person.
Awesome, cool.
But yeah, once again, you guys are playing March 12th at the Showbox Soto here in Seattle. Hopefully the weather's a little bit nicer for you guys when you get here.
Okay.
So I'll keep my fingers crossed for you.
Awesome. Okay, we'll see you very soon, and good talking to you.
All right, good to talk to you too. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, there you have it, everybody. Our interview with Mr. Eric Axelson, the bass player for the Dismemberment Plan. Man, what a cool guy. What an absolute treat to talk to that guy. Even before we started the interview, he like talked to me for like 15 minutes on the phone. Just bullshitting. So I hope I get to meet the guy in person, because he is an absolute gem. And if you haven't heard the Dismemberment Plan before or seen them live, come on down to the Showbox in Seattle on March 12th. That's a Saturday. Tickets are $23 advanced, and I think $25 at the door. And opening also two great bands, The Globes and Mount St. Helens Vietnam Band, which is a lot of fun also. So hopefully I will see you there. Remember, everybody, go to our website, air-raid.net. We've got a link to the Varel and Amplifiers website there that you can check out. Also, in order to keep on getting these cool people on the show, which I really enjoy, and I know that you who listen also do, in order to get these people on the show, we need you guys. I am pleading with you. You can't see this right now because this is fake radio, but I am on my knees right now pleading with you to go to iTunes. Subscribe to the show, and leave us a rating, you know, and be real with it. You know, you don't have to give us 5 stars. It'd be nice, but yeah, help us out a little bit. Write a short review. Takes a couple seconds. Click on, you know, however many stars you think we deserve for doing this show, because in the long run, that is what people look at, when they decide that they want to come on. So, we need your help out there. Pleading with you. I'm down on one knee. Anyway, air-raid.net. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Our handle is airraidnet. Check us out there. And I hope you guys all enjoyed the show. And we will see you next week with the start of a 2-part episode, the Emerald City Comic Con Extravaganza, with Andrew Moore. You may remember him from one of our past episodes, the ex vocalist for Kane Hodder, and a friend of mine, Will Campbell, who is going to be sitting in for Sam Sahonis because he cannot make it to the Comic Con. So that's going to be a 2-part. So the next 2 episodes, Emerald City Comic Con. Hopefully we meet William Shatner. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. We're gonna try to get him on tape. Probably swearing at me to get out of this film. All right, everybody, we're gonna go out today with another song by the Dismemberment Plan off of Emergency and I. Oh, and before we went into the interview, that was the song What Do You Want Me to Say off of the same album, this reboot. So go out and buy it. It's an awesome album. One of my all-time favorites. This is The City by Dismemberment Plan. And thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Notice the street lamps on the ghosts of graffiti. They couldn't quite erase the blank face stares on the subway as people go home. The parks lay empty like my unmade bed. The streets are silent like a lifeless telephone. And this is where I live, but I never felt less at home. So I'm not unsympathetic. I see why you left. There's no one to know. There's nothing to do. The city's been dead.